Hey, yo, what's going on, fam? Thank you for locking in again. This is Clarity with CK Podcast Season 4, and today I'm joined by Jennifer Blanchett, a licensed psychotherapist and neuroscience specialist as well. Thank you, Jen, for coming on the show. I truly appreciate this opportunity to just touch on these super interesting topics and human behavior in general.
Thanks so much for having me.
We were just briefly talking about social media and attention deficits and what's going on in the world right now with new technologies. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how we use these technologies today?
Yeah, so much is there. There's so much there. So I am a fan of technology as well. And I think that we need to leverage technology and have it work for us and not have it run our lives. Because I think there's a tendency, because it's a dopamine hit every time we scroll on social media and we kind of get that over and over again. However, we don't realize that we're taxing our brain with a lot of the different media that we're consuming, for how we're utilizing media in general. And I'm not just talking about social media, I'm talking about the email pings, the text messages, the other things that you might have if you're doing, you know, technology through work. You know, it could be like a Slack channel or all the different things. You know, I was thinking about when I first came into the field of mental health, when I left work, I didn't check my email until, okay, I went on my desktop at home or something like that. But now it's on our devices. So a lot of times we're getting emails. So it's like our brain's never really off. We never really have that time to just be present in our day. So I have to think about, you know, how are you really going throughout your day and how are you maximizing your brain's potential? Because the use of media throughout our day is actually shortening our attention span. So they did a study, and I don't have it right in front of me, but basically we're getting to have the attention of close to a goldfish, which is kind of crazy when you think about it, because we're not thinking about cognitive and brain rest, which our brain desperately needs throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And they're very simple things that you can incorporate, but I think just thinking about that and what media and just all this modern life is doing to our attention span and the cognitive load that we're all experiencing, myself included. So I'm included in that.
So can you give me some examples of these things that you can incorporate to your day-to-day to basically rest your brain?
Yeah, so, you know, my licensed clinical psychologist, a doctor of psychology, and a lot of my experience has been working with folks who have injured their brains. So these techniques can be applied to people that don't have an injury, but learning how to increase attention is really trying to be in your body more. So it's that mind-body integration, which we all hear about, but we don't think of if you maybe don't have an injury. So one of the cool techniques I found actually from a neurooptometrist was something called the 20-20-20 technique. So instead of staring at your screen, I have like a tree right behind me. So I'm looking up. I'm looking at 20 something 20 feet in the distance. So I'm looking at this tree that's 20 feet off, something that's not a screen, right? I'm gonna stare at that 20 feet in the distance, 20 feet off a 20-foot object. For 20 seconds, every 20 minutes. So 20, 20, wow. 20 rule. So every 20 minutes, your brain needs that cognitive rest. So you might've heard like you can probably hold attention for about 20 minutes. That's a normal brain, that's not an injured brain. So most of us have that attention span. That's why TED Talks often are that length of time.
Right.
Because wow. After that time, we're on to something else. And nowadays we're scrolling out of the TED Talk if it doesn't capture us in 30 seconds. And we're like, okay, I'm in this thing. So every 20 minutes you do that 20, 20. And it's helpful for your eyes because our brain has about 80% of it has visual components to our brain. So to think we need really need the eye rest to help our brain rest. So that's one way. And I'm just thinking about also the mind integration piece throughout your day. You know, are you moving? Are you in like the computer position all day long where your body's locked up? And so incorporating the senses is really important. So I love people to get outside every day. Even if it just snowed for the first time here in Maine in the US. And so snow's on the ground. So like experience that. Think about how children experience the world. Mm-hmm. They give us really good clues about mind-body integration. It doesn't have to be complex. Like, okay, go outside. What does it sound like out there? What does the snow sound like when you're crunching on it? Or whatever it looks like in your country. You know, looking at the changing leaves or looking at changes in your environment. Listening. You know, seeing all those different things, we're incorporating our senses throughout our day. So that's kind of true mind-body integration. And then if you do some of those practices, like a relaxation practice every day, that's an added bonus, but you don't have to. you know, you can just be in your environment and really use your senses to help your brain and mind reset. So that's another way. My favorite way, you know, a lot of people I know, probably mental health professionals, like, go do yoga. I do yoga. I've been yoga trained for my 200-hour yoga training, but I lift weights and I breathe and I have mind-body awareness during that. So it could also be lifting weights or through mindful exercise that you're doing that.
Crazy. I didn't expect that. Like, you usually only hear, like, do yoga, do meditation, do Pilates, do whatever, but never lift weights. And I heard that on a podcast with Dr. Huberman. He's very famous for his neuroscience talks, and he did talk about muscle reinforcement, and he talked about the benefits of building muscle and strengthening your body, basically, because that's what our bodies were designed to do, right?
Yeah. And I think we, a lot of times, modern life, again, has taken us out of using our bodies through work. So if you think of even 40 years ago, what was work like for most people? They were probably moving more. And I think a lot of the problems with modern life, with brain function, with our ability to be productive and stay focused, is lack of movement. And we see that throughout the research, through neuroscience research, we see, you know, reduced rates of Alzheimer's, dementia, even other physical illnesses from movement. So just by having, it doesn't have to be a crazy exercise regime. Walking is great exercise. So even if you're incorporating that walking, here in America, the CDC recommends 150 minutes of movement per, I like to say movement instead of exercise, because a lot of people are exercising, like, I gotta do, like, get up back on the wheel with exercise. No, it could be walking, doing something, walking the dog. That's actually great movement for your brain and for your mental health.
What does the research say about productivity today compared to, like you said, 40 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at that research recently, but I know the attention rates are down in general. And I think that's largely due to modern life and movement. Productivity rates, I would imagine, I've seen the research, but I can't quote the study in my brain, but I know I've seen it, is reduced. And I think that's from some of the things that we've mentioned, that we are kind of overtaxing our brain cognitively through computer work, through other things. And I think socially, we have to think about, there's a component cognitively that's really important. So there was a huge study that was done on social belongingness and connectedness and different measures of health effects that people have had. So let's talk about, like, morbidity. And the people that were more socially connected had lower rates of morbidity across the board. So even if they were smoking, even if they were obese, even if they had other things you think, oh, that person definitely would have a higher morbidity rate. But if they had social connectedness, then the research is indicating that they were still having a longer life. So that social connectedness piece is really essential and important, that we should think about that. In modern life, we know we're less connected. You know, the family breakdown, extended family breakdown. And that might be better in some other countries. I don't know. You could probably speak more to, like, France, but definitely in the US, we are less connected.
It's a global phenomenon, to be honest. I've seen it not just in France, in Europe as a whole, and even in Africa, where I was in Southeast Asia, in South America. I've seen it everywhere, and people are starting to realize it. Obviously, not as much as in the US, where people are definitely more connected thanks to, you know, the infrastructure and whatnot. But I feel like it's definitely a global phenomenon where people have gotten away from a certain way of life. Like, I always take the example of the 90s. I was born in the early 90s and basically grew up in the late 90s. And I do remember my childhood, and I do remember how often we used to get together with friends and, you know, have kids' activities together, go to friends' places, go with my parents to other friends' places and chill and talk and whatnot. And now, even at home, when I used to look at my parents at that point, we used to have dinner together all the time. There was a TV, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know. But to me, a TV definitely shouldn't be part of family activities, but that's another topic. There was a TV, but we still had conversations, like, around dinner. We still had conversations throughout the day. We looked at each other in the eye and did stuff, like, physically. We went out on weekends, we went biking, we went walking. I don't think we do that anymore. I don't see my parents do that anymore. All they do now is they stay on their phones, and, you know, they're definitely more informed on more stuff. But there's this comedian who said, I feel like one of the objectives of the American society is to put as many screens between us and the TV. And I find that funny, but it's extremely true as well, because now we don't watch TV for the TV. Like, you're watching a football game and you're tweeting about it. So there's a screen already between you and the TV. And sometimes you're actually working. So you're watching the TV, you're working on your computer, and you have your phone in your hand. So there are like two screens between you and the TV. So we don't even look at the TV the way we used to. And I feel like that definitely hindered the way we connect with each other. And I believe that there are so many problems today within families, extended families as well, that can be traced back to that. Like, we don't listen to people like we used to. We text instead of, you know, meet up and do stuff together. And I definitely think that plays a huge role in how we shape our societies today. What is your take on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think I definitely see it, you know, in the counseling room too, with families, you know, especially with parents of teens, you know, they're like, well, you know, I text my teen who's in their room because, you know, they say I'm yelling at them if I yell through the door or whatever. That's how they're communicating. So they're not really having face-to-face. They're not having family dinners, which I think is the lifeblood of a family, is being able to, you know, have a meal and really kind of unpack the day screen-free. That's something I implement. It's very simple, but something I implement in my family, where it's a screen-free meal. Like, we're not on our screens. We're just face-to-face. I say eyeball time. We need eyeball time to be able to just look at each other's faces and check in. So that simple connection, we're not going to change modern life. Screens are here. They're not going away. But how can we go back to that connection? How can we have touch points throughout our day where that's not part of our lives, where we're having that connection, we're feeling known and seen by somebody? So I think it's doable, but it has to be intentional. It has to be a practice and a rhythm of your life.
It must be really difficult today to handle that. Like, I think my parents are grateful that this whole technology thing, I mean, at least phones, came about when I was in my teen years, but it wasn't that common. Like, not everyone had a phone back then. So we had that time prior where, you know, my mom would still, you know, yell at me from downstairs. And we had those moments right before. I think if I was born a little bit later, things would have been different. It's sad because in communication in general, humans get 90% of what we say through physical body movement, body communication.
Right. You're right on that.
Not voice. So there's that. If you're not looking at someone while they're talking to you, you're missing the 90% of what they're trying to say. And we see it in text, right? Like, when you exchange emails or even text with someone, you don't know the tone in which they're saying something. Now, you touched on something extremely important, which is human behavior and how, you know, society is changing. And we're getting a little bit into that through what we're saying. How do you believe we can improve as a society as a whole? Because, like you said, phones are, and technology is here, and there's no way around it. It would be naive to just say that we can just stop using phones. It's, I think, impossible. But what can we do to regulate that? Because I don't see, like, you know, governments regulate that. It's their bread and butter, and it's the bread and butter of a lot of industries today. So how can we, you know, find ways to improve on that?
Yeah. I think it goes back to your rhythms in your day. You know, having certain rhythms where you're not using your phone at all. You know, you're going to use your phone, but trying to be mindful of when that phone use happens. You know, you don't need to get up in the morning and go to run on your phone. You don't have to. No. You know, I think kind of having the rhythm, and I need to get back to this because I can, it's so easy to fall into like, wake up, check your messages, see what's going on in social media. And like, then by the time you know, it's like 30, 45 minutes has passed. And then it's like, what do I even do with that time?
But so, it feels good though.
Tell me more.
It feels good. Like, when you do it, when you wake up and you look at your phone and you've answered already like a couple of emails and answered a couple of texts that you received like last night. And I write stuff on my notes, like new ideas and stuff that just comes to my mind. It feels good, you know, in a sense, like in the moment, obviously afterwards. And when I see that, you know, there are periods in my life where I was addicted to my phone, when I realized that, it felt horrible. But when you're in that moment, it does feel good.
See, I'm gonna go way back because I'm a child of the 80s. And so I didn't even grow up with a computer in my house. And so I didn't have a computer until I went to college. And so I remember like the Yahoo, like, you got mail. I still remember that reaction a little bit in the body, like, oh, I got mail. Like, that's exciting. So there's a little thing that happens when we get a text message and we kind of go in there and see what it is, even though it's not as juicy as like the back in the day Yahoo, when everyone was excited about this new technology. but there's that little hit of dopamine that your brain gets by, you know, kind of doing something. But is that time the best use of your time? So thinking of, is it better for me to like make sure that I have my morning routine set, that I've had some time to write out my day and be intentional and think about that before I get into my phone and check the boxes off, checking the messages and responding to a couple of things. So I find the rhythm of writing. I mean, I really like writing on a piece of paper when I'm in a good space. Do I always do this? No. But in my best self, this is what happens, where I'm kind of like shutting down my day, putting the phone on the charger, and then like reading a book at night. Like, my phone does not go upstairs when I go to bed. It's not, it doesn't even go in that zone. That's something I have implemented, that the phone never goes upstairs with me. And I find that that just time for, number one, my eyes to rest. We'd forget about people. Another huge problem modern society we have is sleep. So as a society, we are not sleeping nearly as much as we need to. And part of that is the screen use, because when it's nighttime, you think about before, lights are lower. It's telling your brain it's time to get ready to sleep. However, when we have light constantly that we're looking at, it's telling our brain we need to be awake. So I think messages to tell our brain, like lowered lights, like dimming all the lights in your house can be helpful, even if you're looking at the phone, just to kind of get that melatonin kind of juice flowing in the brain and the body that it's time to wind down for bed. So, you know, I know I kind of went off topic, but I went on to sleep a little bit, because it is important and it's good to think about as our like overall functioning.
Crazy. I have three questions for you. So we'll go one by one. The first one, and I had it like earlier, which is, will all this activity and brain activity basically develop our brains into, let's say, more up-to-date machines, or will it in the end just burn us out?
Well, I mean, I think you have to think about efficiency. If you're constantly in your phone and you're kind of ping-ponging, we all know what it's like to be kind of stuck in the phone when you've gotten stuck in your phone and what that kind of feels like. It recently happened just a couple of days ago. Like, my kids stressed me out, I'm not gonna lie. They were just off the chain. They're 7 and 9 and they're really active boys, and they just weren't listening all day. So I just kind of completely checked out into my phone, was scrolling social media, and I got stuck there for about 45 minutes. And what should I have done to regulate my nervous system? My body probably needed me to either just lay down, drink a glass of water, do something different. Cause afterwards I kind of had that phone hangover where you're just like, ugh. That's how I chose to regulate myself in the moment, but it wasn't the best regulation tool that I could have used.
So you think in the end, our brains are all over the place all the time, way too much. Ultimately, it's gonna burn us out as a culture, as a society.
Well, we know cognitively we're declining. Like, that, the research is clear with
that. That's what I was getting at, basically.
Yeah, so the research is clear that our attention spans are getting reduced.
Okay.
So it's telling us that it is overtaxing our cognitive functioning. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty clear. So how we get that back is doing some of the things that I talked about, is trying to have more intentionality in your day. And when I worked with people who had injury to the brain, they couldn't do it. So before, someone who had a concussion or a brain injury, right? They could be on their screens 8 hours, 10 hours. They could just be on the screens all day if they wanted. But now they can only spend like maybe 30 minutes to an hour before they get an intense headache and they have to lay down. So I teach them skills of pacing, to tell them like, hey, like, you need to think about your breaks before you kind of get to like a 3 out of 10 on that headache scale, to know you need that rest. And I think the gift of a brain injury, which is it's a tragic event, and I'm not saying but to see that silver lining, is that it teaches people pacing. And there's other experiences I think everyone has that teaches us like a reset, like we need a reset in our life, whether that be a relationship rupture, whether that be someone who's passed, you know, like a loved one who's passed away. We all have those resets to have more intentionality. It doesn't have to be a brain injury. It doesn't have to be, you know, someone dying, but it could just be, I want to be more intentional in my day. I want to have more focus and be more productive, or I have this huge goal that I want to get to. How do you get there? By being intentional. By knowing that, like, okay, this is how I'm lining up my day so I can be the most productive, and that, so I can actually think about that thing. I can think about playing. I can think about living. I can think about being a human.
Mm-hmm. So,
and for me, that's tennis. You know, I think about, that's what I'm in there hitting that ball, and I'm pretty competitive with tennis, honestly. So yeah, thinking about that play aspect is so important too.
Of course. So just to get back one last time to the question I just asked, so you think by the reduction of our attention spans and all the mental issues that we have today, you think that if we keep on this track, then this generation and the next generations will have more cognitive issues as they age. I'm thinking Alzheimer's, for example. Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility, certainly, because we're not moving, we're not connected. And those are the two biggest things we see in the research with regard to cognitive issues later in life is our ability to physically stay healthy through movement and also social connectedness so that we have people that know us, that we know them. Another plug for tennis. So tennis players have some of the longest longevity of any other sport or activity, I think, because we're very social. So if you're playing tennis with this group of people, like, you're gonna grab a beer after, or you're gonna go, you know, grab coffee with a friend, and it's very, very social in that respect. So thinking about things that you can, you know, have people know you through, whatever you're into, like hiking groups, or, you know, I don't know what you're into, or if you have like groups of people that you kind of interact with.
Yeah, hiking, soccer, those type of, you know, sports where you definitely, you definitely can feel the connectedness with other people. Thing is, like, I myself and a bunch of people I know are more of loners. So we enjoy our alone time. What does that mean? And how does that, you know, influence our brain aging?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think for people who tend to be more loners or introverts, you know, there's just maybe less capacity for you want to go in those big groups. Exactly. However, you still need to feel known by other people. So that could be in smaller settings, you know, maybe if like you're a podcaster, maybe you hook up with other podcasters and you guys talk about whatever, like the trade of podcasting. I'm a podcaster too. So it's finding ways to have that connection. And I would say in-person connection is important. So whether that be family, I mean, it could be family. You get together with family every week and there's like a rhythm with that, whether it's Sunday night dinners. And I think for men too, it can be a little bit more difficult. I think women socially, we're very different.
Right.
You know, female friendship relationships, and I am talking about in like, I'm not talking about non-binary folks or folks that are in the LGBTQ population. So that might be different. But if we're thinking of kind of some male relationships can be more challenging. There is a calling to be a little more intentional about that relationship structure. And it tends to be more of an activity around sports, around, you know, common interests and things like that. Sure. But it's worth your time. And longevity speaks to that. So, you know, you're going to live longer if you have a group of people that know you and belong to you that's outside of your immediate family.
Okay. How can you program your brain basically to think long term? Because all of these issues stem from the fact that we're too short term thinking. Everyone wants everything right now, you know, and we kind of got used to that. And I think social media played a huge role in that cultural shift. That being said, to get that longevity, you need patience and you need consistency. But how can you reprogram your brain to think like that and to be like, well, I'm doing this for, you know, for my 30 year from now self? How can you start thinking like that? Because I find that quite, you know, challenging.
It is challenging. I think it's challenging to think of your future self. I often like to have my future self as a persona. Like, I'm doing this for future Jen, or, you know, and I have clients. I help them think about that too. Because right now it can seem easy to just ignore a problem.
Right.
Or to let something go. But you have to think about, is that going to benefit me in the long run? So I think it's somewhat mindset. And I think thinking of those rhythms of intentionality where you're kind of reviewing what's the most important thing to you in this season, that is really important. And for me, that gets into kind of existential things and into spirituality as well. Like, what is it really important to me as a human, as a family, as just a person that's in this life? And like, what do I want my life to mean? And that gets into all kinds of other things. But I think to really start to dig into those questions is important, and to write it out, you know, write out like, what is the most important thing to me in this season? For me, I can say it's my mothering. It's my two boys and making sure that they feel loved and supported. And I do have career goals, and that's kind of secondary to my family goals right now. In other seasons, it's been flopped because it hasn't, you know, I didn't have a family before, so I was focused on becoming a psychologist because I wanted to promote change in people and help people feel heard and understood and heal from trauma and heal from things that have happened to them. So I think it's just reviewing all the time, reviewing like, how did today go? How could I get to more intentionality to that goal or to that purpose that I think that I should be focused on?
All right, well, that's a great answer. Thank you for that. I will definitely meditate on these beautiful words. Now, I like digging into the risks because I feel like a lot of people want to know the benefits, but they also want to know what the risks are if they keep perpetuating a certain behavior. What are the risks if we keep not sleeping well enough? Because like you touched on earlier, we're definitely not sleeping enough and we're not sleeping well enough, and our brains are not getting enough chances to reset, to update. So what are the risks, like long term, for us as a whole, not individually, if we keep on that path?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly research is telling us like early mortality is one of those risks, increased health problems from, and I think chronic stress is also an issue, right? If you're not managing chronic stress, and your body feels like it's constantly in a state of danger, and it may not be, you may not have a trauma that has happened to you, but you could feel like, I have so much going on that like then things start to feel dangerous in my life. And I can speak to that personally. In the pandemic, I got to a level of stress with managing my clients and my family that I developed a panic attack, panic disorder, and had, you know, I couldn't drive on the highway without having a panic attack. I went through treatment, and I myself got help for that issue. But if I hadn't worked through that issue, maybe I couldn't drive on the highway anymore, for example. So I think I can personally speak to what that can look like. And everybody has something. Everybody, when their stress is not managed, it can develop into this three-headed monster that we never thought it could.
Right. Wow. And what are the best ways for you to manage that stress?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's definitely movement and also pacing throughout my day. You know, some days I work at home, other days I work out of the home. So having a rhythm that kind of works for me, being around my dog so I can like be with him. He's a really good stress reducer. Right. So that's really helpful. And also changing my work. You know, I had to change my work in a significant way after the pandemic.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing mostly therapy. So I kind of changed. I'm doing podcasting now, doing some consulting work. So like you can change. You don't have to do things the way you've always done things. If they're not working for you. So that's one message I would tell people. Mm-hmm. And I'm a testament to that. You know, I can't do this way anymore. So I think that's one way of thinking of like, what's not working? And then what could work for me? Keep trying things until you find that mix.
Awesome. I love that. And I want to touch on a different subject, a subject you know a lot about, trauma and healing from trauma. Can you briefly explain what trauma is first and foremost, and what the most common traumas you see are? And then maybe dig a little bit deeper into some of the easiest ways, let's say, for people to just heal from their traumas, because I feel like there is a lot of it, especially nowadays in our society.
Yeah, so trauma is witnessing something where your body felt like, or had the perception, which is very important, that it was in danger, that you could have lost your life. So, and that could be by witnessing it, personally experiencing it. And for myself, had been hearing the traumas of other people. So as a therapist, I experienced trauma symptoms, and they call that vicarious traumatization, actually hearing the traumatic stories of other people. So I think the key thing is that perception, because a lot of people will tell me like, well, it's not like I had like a trauma. And I'm like, well, your body thought that. Your body believed that you did, and you're experiencing those symptoms. So that could, you know, we see that from some folks with COVID. They didn't get COVID, but they still believe they're gonna have a problem. They don't go outside. Like I've worked with people that are still struggling with fears of a infectious illness, for example, because their body is telling them that would kill me. Hmm. Even though that may not be scientific anymore, that's what their body believes. And so you have to work on that perception. So that's one way. You know, certainly I can speak to myself as having, you know, struggling with vicarious traumas at different times in my career. Healing from trauma. I didn't answer that question.
Right.
The best modality that I have found, and that's a type of therapy, is EMDR, is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. So essentially every trauma therapy, the goal of that trauma therapy is for your body to feel like when I have that memory of that traumatic experience, my body no longer has reactions. So right now, so we could say it wasn't a trauma, but my body felt like I was in danger when I used to drive on the highway. Now, when I think about highway driving, I don't have physiological reactions to thinking about highway driving. Previously, I did. So like for someone like a veteran, I've worked with veterans before.
Right.
When they think about that event, they no longer have physiological distress. they might have sadness. They might, you know, still think about that memory and it might be difficult, but they don't have like the heart racing or clenching or doing things like that from that trauma.
Good. Happy to hear that. And that there are ways for people to get past that. You know, when you talked about panic attacks and anxiety, I did have those like in 2014, I think, for the first time. And I had no idea where they came from. And earlier we touched on, you know, social media and the overuse and the over solicitation of our brains. And that was definitely a period of mostly that in my life. I remember like just going to public places used to make me sick and make me think that I was about to die and whatnot. I got through it through meditation and spirituality. So I actually isolated myself on an actual uninhabited island. I was there for a couple of weeks and I did nothing but write. I had a couple of books with me and a notebook where I would write every day because that's all I had to do. It was uninhabited, so there was no electricity, no running water, none of that.
Wow.
And I did that for like, well, it was 13 days to be exact. And prior to going there, I had to take a plane. It was a 5-hour flight, 4.5. And literally I had like a bunch of panic attacks, heart palpitations. It was crazy. And so when I got there, I was like, well, now I just have to get to that island. And then whatever happens, happens. So I kind of like accepted my fate. And in the end, like just the fact that I took a step back from everything, like every screen imaginable, every one of my daily routines, like there was nothing that I could do like I would do at home. So I completely changed everything upside down and I was out of my comfort zone clearly. That sort of like reset everything for me. Like I'm not saying I didn't have any more anxiety attacks or like panic attacks afterwards. Not at all. That would be a lie. But I didn't have them like as consistently, and then in the end they just went away. I find that fascinating because now whenever I start feeling like overwhelmed, I go to the mountains and I hike for like 3 days and then I come back down and I'm feeling like a new person.
Yeah.
So those are like the tips that you were talking about earlier, like movement. And I might add like, and you tell me if this helps, but for me, like getting out of a routine, getting out of your comfort zone, getting out of something that you already know.
And it sounds like you connected to, you know, what was sacred to you. You know, I don't know what your belief structure is, but it sounds like going to that mountain or going to that place was connecting with something larger than yourself. And that was part of your healing, and which I've found to be a large part of other people's healing that I've worked through, is connecting to the sacred, whatever belief structure you have.
Crazy. It's one of those things that you just, like, I never learned about this. Like most people, unfortunately, like we don't talk about these things, that we used to stigmatize these things way more than we do now. We still do, but it was way more stigmatized back then. And
yeah. And I think there's so much wisdom that we have in our sacred traditions,
right,
that we need to lean on those, especially during this time. So if you have a belief system or you adhere to spirituality or religion, like there's so much wisdom in how to, you know, really reset your mind and body and soul that I think we should not ignore.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you on that. But I feel like once again, modern societies have tried to take out of the equation all of these things that you're touching on right now, like religion and spirituality. It's become a hip thing to go to a spiritual retreat, church, or to go to a mosque. I mean, there are obviously certain countries, cultures, traditions that have held on to that. But I feel like especially in Western countries, we try to distance ourselves from that. And now we're seeing some sort of rise in mental issues. And so it's a really good point that you bring up there. Let's talk a little bit about mental health, because that's where we're touching on from the beginning of this. We just didn't want to call it that, I guess, because every little detail of all of this is connected to mental health. In your years of experience, of practice, of studies, of human experience, what are some of the best things that you could tell people struggling with mental health in general, aside from, you know, being active, being present, eating healthy, I guess, as well?
Yeah, nutrition is really important. Yeah, I would think my pillars, you know, of brain health are in that the sleep, nutrition, right, movement, mm-hmm, we know, and belonging. So I kind of think through the kind of belonging, four prongs of that. Yeah, the connection. We don't think about how important connection is in our relationships. And you hear a lot of people talk about the nutrition, the sleep, you know, those types of things, yeah, the movement, like, okay, yeah, we just fix those things.
Yeah.
But if we're not known, that's inherent to our humanity, that we feel like we're known, that we belong. And I think that's largely not to mean that there's not organic mental illness, because there is, you know, especially we know like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, especially those can be more organic or come from our biology. So it's not like, I don't think that everything can be managed just in those things, or that they should be. But I think of those as like lowering our baseline, we're having problems, right? So if we have like a predisposition towards anxiety or depression, which are the common colds of mental health, by the way, then we can do those things to kind of keep things at bay, if you will. But if we have a major life event, or if we have some serious mental illness, then that might be looking to really specific expert help. And that there's no problem. Like, we do that for our physical health. Like, we think like, okay, I got this mole and like my history of cancer in my family, I'm gonna go to a specialist and get help. We don't think, maybe I'll just put some cream on it and like keep moving.
Right.
No, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Mental health is part of our physical body. Our brain is connected to our body.
Right.
So we wanna just destigmatize that. Almost everyone I've met in my entire life has struggled to some degree with some level of mental health in their life. So there's times in our life we might need that support. It doesn't always have to be a trained mental health professional. It could be, you know, someone who has some training, or that maybe if you feel more comfortable going to like someone in a church or a mosque, or someone who has a spiritual background, hey, go do that. If that person can meet that need, that's okay. I just read some research actually for like, they have this training for grandmothers in Africa that will just like sit on a bench. And well, they have a, you know, it's a peer-led mental health program, and they would just sit with someone, so on a bench with a grandmother, and they found that it reduces depression. So it doesn't mean that you have to be with somebody that is like a doctor like me, because there's not enough of me out there. We need to look to other solutions.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I feel like in many, many cultures that at least I've had the chance to visit, I found that all of them have a certain support system, which is practically what you just described. It can be like, you know, a gathering that they do once a week where they just inquire about each other's well-being, mental wellness, and how everyone is doing, and just attending to the needs of the weakest of the group, because that's how many of these cultures in the world, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South America, in different parts of the planet, believe that we are as strong as our weakest link. So they tend to have these, usually it's a weekly thing where they just gather somewhere. Doesn't necessarily have to be sacred, but they do at least keep the human as the sacred part of their cultures. And so this has existed for thousands of years.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of sad that, you know, in this age of transformation and communication, we are the most disconnected. And we've definitely like steered away from each other, basically. I don't know how to explain that, because at first, like you said, Yahoo and MySpace and, you know, High Five, and there were so many social platforms before where you could go and actually meet people and then meet them in real life. I've experienced that myself with the earliest social platforms. And then as time went on, we replaced that with just becoming lazy, I guess, or procrastinators. And in the end, we just got away from what matters the most. Why do you think that shift happened? Why did people distance themselves from other people, basically, in this age where, you know, it seems like it's super easy to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I go back to the family. I mean, I think it started more with separation in families, where families were breaking down. You know, certainly it started with that, because even before social media, there was higher rates of mental health with divorce and things like that. So if you think about the family as really the unit that helps protect us, right? And if that unit is not functioning well, that's our first line of defense, really, to help us feel supported and loved and that we belong. So I go back to that unit, and how that unit is functioning is really the most change that anyone can do in their life, is have a family that has rituals of connection, that where you feel supported and loved at home. And then that can be an outgrowth of other relationships that you have with other people. So I think it started there. And I think, but our social construction of relationship became different. Even if you think of dating, how dating was. So I, you know, met my husband back in 2008, before really more the advent of dating apps.
Right.
And now myself working with people who are dating, like in the counseling room, I'm just like, wow, it's like this routine you have to go through with messaging someone. And then like, maybe they'll message you back. I don't know. But it's like this whole dance of kind of digital connection that someone has to do before you can actually face-to-face, either on a screen or in person, meet someone.
It feels like a scripted dance nowadays. The genuine side is fading away. Like I said, it's a routine. It's literally like a choreography. Mm-hmm. You have to play along, and if you don't follow certain steps, then it may not work out. So you have to go through these steps.
Mm-hmm. And if it's not successful, you can get right back on the app tomorrow or to that night, and then you'll have a date tomorrow maybe.
Exactly.
Or in a couple days or something. So then there's not as much pressure or commitment even to that person to say, I really want to give it 3 dates, which is my role in therapy. Give someone 3 dates to make a decision on if that relationship is going to be a go or no go. That's important.
That's true. And the 3 dates reminds me of something else, something I learned through slow living, which is just pacing yourself through all of everything that you do, but also through decisions and decision making.
Yeah. I think if we can try to slow life down more, because it is at this rapid pace, it's better, you know, putting less things in our day, putting more white space in our calendar. So our calendar is not like boom, 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 appointment, appointment, thing, thing, thing. But especially for someone who's creative, like you and I are both creatives, we're podcasters, you need your brain to basically be bored, to be creative. Like the best ideas that I have for podcasting come in the shower, or they come when I'm driving and doing, you know, kind of like, look, I let myself not listen to stuff in the car because I don't want my mind to wander. And we forget that art of being bored and what happens in our brains when we just kind of let things flow.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you on that one, because it's literally part of my slow living lifestyle. Being bored is, to me, of utter importance, because I noticed that, you know, one time I was standing in line and literally everyone was on their phone, and obviously I'm guilty of that too. I mean,
yeah, same.
The thing is, like, it made me realize that before the existence of iPhones, we had that time throughout our days where we would be in line for bread, for lunch, for dinner, waiting for the bus. We had that time to look around and to do that 20-20-20 exercise and look at trees and look at buses coming and going, looking at other people, just getting cues from society, from the life that's around us. And since the introduction of phones into our pockets, into our hands, we stopped that. I found that extremely interesting, because some of the best ideas and one of the topics that I touched on my podcast was that one, because I was in line, I didn't have my phone, and I could think about something different and then expose it to an art form that is podcasting. So the fact that you talk about being bored and how important it is for the brain to just process all the information, the incoming information, the constant information that's coming through our screens, is monumental, and it's healthy.
Yeah, it's really good for you cognitively, just to allow your brain just to do whatever it's doing. Like if you're folding the laundry, right, like you can fold the laundry.
Yeah.
And sometimes I love podcasts, and I'm listening to podcasts a lot too while I'm doing stuff, but I try to unplug as well and be more present, because I know that's important to me and my brain and my family and all the things. And I was thinking of that line, so I have a funny story about a line, because, you know, there's like less staff everywhere throughout the world where there's only a certain amount of people that check out.
Yep.
So there's a huge line, and it's a chance for connection that we don't think about, you know,
right,
that we used to maybe talk with somebody, and this woman was talking to me, and I was like, okay, I'll move over lines, is that okay? And we had this little moment. And so I have a bottle of wine. I don't drink that much, but I do like a little bit of red wine. So I'm not promoting drinking. So anyway, I have my wine and I'm like transferring my things. And she's like, you're going to need that wine tonight. And I just like did this as a simple joke. And like the line laughed, and the people that were looking laughed, not the people who were like this or like
looking
like that. But it's a chance for a connection that we forget about.
Of course. And these moments, to me, they still happen, but only in specific spaces like airports, where people, I don't know, maybe they don't have enough roaming data, so they just stay off their phones. But for me, like these moments, I still find that they happen quite often in airports. But yeah, you're definitely not gonna see that, you know, waiting for the metro or waiting somewhere like in a bakery, except with old people. Old people will talk to you. Like, I mean, least here, they do. They come up to you, they ask you about stuff, they make comments. And for me, like, that's an integral part of the human experience. There's this one guy, I was waiting in line and we kept looking at each other because we were the only two minorities in that shop that day. And he kept looking at me and I kept looking at him. And then when he finished, he just, you know, walked past me. He put his hand on my shoulder, like, I see you. And I was like, I see you too. Nice. And he just walked out. And that moment, I still remember it to this day, just to tell you how important these little moments of connection with someone with whom you seemingly have something in common is. And right. I feel like we literally give little to no importance to these little moments of life.
Yeah, and research tells us, so like having connections to acquaintances, so is important for our mental health. So if you have a chance to talk to the cashier at the register or someone in the store, like that connection has mental health benefits throughout your day, because it is a human connection, even though we don't know them. We may not even know their name, but maybe we say like, thank you so much. Like, you were really helpful today and I really appreciated you. That oxytocin release from you to them, that's that kind of love or caring hormone. Like, they feel that, you feel that throughout your day. So never forget like the importance of just incorporating that into like going and being really just a nice person in a checkout line. It's important.
Yeah, and these little positive comments as well. I was super into that like a few years ago, where I tried to set my mind to always remember to say positive things even when there isn't a need for. Like I say, when you're just walking out, thank you so much for your service. Thank you so much for smiling, for being just a warm human being. Good luck with the rest of your day, with your work, with, you know, what you're doing for all of us. It's like gifts given, you know? Like I've realized this in my life. Like, the more gifts I give, the happier I feel. And now when I receive gifts, I'm like, okay, well, of course, there's a little bit of excitement. It depends on the person, of course, but...
And as a therapist, I would say gifts can be words. So we can give gifts of our words and give like someone a verbal hug, even if it's not appropriate to hug them. Uh-huh. Our families, we can hug, right? But to think about those verbal hugs throughout our day that we can give to people as gifts, because it sticks with them.
I love this.
We don't know the impact it might have had on their day.
I will definitely try to implement a little bit of those like more into my daily life. One more question about taking a step back from all of this, trying to leave, you know, blank spaces in your calendar. How do you manage not feeling guilty when you do that? Because my wife is definitely a workaholic. She loves what she does. She's always connected and trying to be productive. And of course, it takes a toll on her and she realizes it. So she takes breaks, but these breaks, you know, they last for couple of days and then she's back on. And I always tell her like, you need breaks, you need to be bored, you need to not do anything. But she always tells me like, I feel super guilty when I don't do anything. Like, she doesn't even want to take naps, although she's like dead tired. And I'm like, but you could literally take a nap right now. And she's like, yeah, but I need to write an article about this or that. And I'm like, you need to take a break sometimes. So how do you avoid feeling that guilt?
It's hard, I think, because of hustle culture. You know, we've gotten into this culture of we are what we produce. And we forget that we're human beings, that we need to do the being part. And I think like the old people in the line, right? I think of old people, like they are so good at that. They are so good at just like, I'm going to sit here and enjoy this cup of tea or this coffee, if you're in America, with you. Although the French drink coffee, right?
They do. They do love coffee here.
Yeah. So like, I'm going to experience what I'm doing and that's okay. It's okay. Like, I'm human and I can have a human moment. We don't have to be producing something, but it has to be something that you work on in your mindset, that you have permission. You have permission not to produce. And so I think it's that doing versus being aspect of life, that there are times that we need to do things, we need to produce, and that is good for us. That is good for us as humans to have some aspect of that, but to look at that balance, and that balance might be different in different seasons of our life. You know, as a mother, there's seasons where I didn't work very much. I worked maybe one day a week and I was with my kiddos the other days of the week and I was just with them. And that was more of a being season. So it could be during that season, you're more being. When I was studying for my doctoral boards and when I was, you know, doing the 4 degrees in psychology, it was very much a doing season. And I had to take breaks, of course, but it just felt like it was constant. But I would argue, you know, certainly that's important at any season in our life. So it's not a direct answer, but just more like to think about kind of the balance. I think it's a balance. And the mix is different for each person, but I think the stress and overwhelm is a cue. Like, at the end of the day, do I feel like I have energy to have a nice dinner with my loved one and talk? That's a good rule of thumb. If I don't have that energy, or I feel like I just need to like, you know, fall over at the end of the day, it's probably too much.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But FOMO is killing us as a society.
Right.
We don't exist unless we create, right? That's how you put it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's how it feels like. When you're in within that hustle culture, it feels like that. But then once you get out, it definitely feels different. Because life goes on, like with or without you, with what you produce or what you don't produce. Like when you realize that, it humbles you. And then it makes you realize that nothing is that important and anything can wait.
It can. It really can. And that's why I think, like, in your body, to feel like all these things feel like they have to happen right now, but they don't. And that's what that going back to that routine of intentionality. What is the one thing or the two things that have to happen today? Everything else doesn't really matter.
Right.
I love that book, The One Thing, because it really has you think of, like, what is that one thing that I need to do today that would be, what would change everything? And I love the best today planners. Those are really good. Like, she has a weekly review.
Okay.
And a daily review where you kind of like do a brain dump and write out all the things that you think need to happen and then kind of have that one thing that you're focusing on for the week or for the month or whatever. And that thing will be the thing that changes whatever it is that you need to happen in your business or in your family life, whatever it is.
One last question to wrap it up. We didn't talk about stress. I would love to connect how social media enhances your stress, negative stress, not positive stress. And how can one just navigate that field?
The stress of your brain constantly having to attend to something causes reduced attention. So if your brain is constantly attending to something, like right now I'm in this conversation with you, I'm not looking at anything else.
Right.
I just have to attend to this. Mm-hmm. However, when I get off this thing, I'll have multiple things I might attend to. I have my email right here. My phone might have text messages on it. Right. My dog is outside. Huh. And so that's, your brain is holding all these things. And the more things you hold, the more cortisol that pumps through your body to kind of say, like, is this stress dangerous? Is this going to cause me a problem if I don't attend to all these things, if you don't manage it correctly? Instead of saying, like, actually, what do I need to do off this call? I probably need a glass of water. And then to think about, okay, let's look at my schedule. That's probably the two things that I need to do. So it's like going into the next thing in a purposeful and intentional way is best. But I think the stress of holding all these things and the notifications that come constantly and your brain feeling like it needs to attend to every one. So one good thing to do is to turn off almost all notifications off your phone. Turn them off completely. Yeah. Because you know where the apps are. You know how to get into them. You don't need that pinging of your brain constantly feeling like it needs to go right to that thing. So especially when you're trying to have focused work, all notifications off, all other things off. I can't turn the dog off, but he's a good distraction. So everything else to think of, like, doing that one thing that you're doing. If you're on your phone, you're doing whatever, like, just let yourself do the phone, like, check all your messages, then turn the notifications off, turn it on silent until you want to check it again.
That's amazing. I definitely apply it because I have no notifications. I only have one, which is for calls. And I know that my friends never call me, so they know that.
Now they know now.
No, I would never pick up.
Who calls anymore? I know you're like, someone's calling?
Yeah, like, it's weird. Like,
or someone knocks on your door, you're like, what? Who's here? Like, what are they, what's happening? Are they going to break down the door?
100%. So yeah, I don't have any notifications. So I double tip you guys with that one. Turn them off. You don't need them. You know where the apps are, like she said. The other thing is, I deleted some social platforms from my phone, like Facebook, like Twitter, and I kept them on my computer. So I know that when I'm not, like, actually doing some specific work, like trying to promote, for example, a podcast or looking for specific information, I don't have access to it. Now, I'm not saying that I'm perfect at that, because I still sometimes find ways to, you know, log into my Twitter.
You can get onto, you know, Google or whatever, but yeah, it's harder.
It's harder. So it keeps you away from it. And sometimes you just open your Google or your Safari and then you find like a page that you were reading about like earlier and you keep on reading and you don't go on social media. So I try to keep it on my computer now. Of course, with Instagram, it's difficult. I left TikTok like a long time ago because I feel like TikTok is the most dangerous of them all in terms of cognitive functions and addiction.
Yeah, I just never got into it. I mean, I got on there a few times, but I was like, there was weird stuff that popped up on it. I think it was more, I was like, oh, what is that? Like, why is my phone coming up and there's like some crazy crap playing on my phone?
Wait until the algorithm gets to know you. Like, that algorithm is so powerful. It literally, like, knows you better than you probably know
yourself. It does. It shows me, like, all the dog videos. It's
you see? And it's barely getting to know you. So trust me, like, if you spend, like, a month on it, it's so
okay.
it's over, because it knows exactly what you need. After a few dog videos, it's gonna send you the one that where you were like, okay, I've seen like five, now I'm done. But then it sends you a sixth one, what it has to do with tennis, and you're like, oh wow, I didn't know this technique. And you would never stop. So yeah, TikTok is the most dangerous one. I left completely because I was like,
I'm glad it never got me. Good.
Don't download it. Just leave it there. You're not missing out on anything important, at least. And yeah, so, well, thank you so much for sharing all these golden nuggets with us.
This was great. Thank you. You're such a curious interviewer, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Well, there you have it, folks. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so probably the easiest place is on Instagram at TBI Therapist.
Perfect. There you have it, folks. You will find all the information below. You'll find her website as well. Thank you, Jennifer, for coming on the show. And until next time, peace.